Welcome to Indo in America. I'm your host, John von Waldshagen. World War II. Simply saying the phrase harkens memories of destruction, violence, a world turned upside down, and devastation not seen before in modern history. In 1945, the Second World War was in full swing, but that was about to change. On August 6, American forces dropped an atom bomb on Hiroshima, Japan. 3 days later, on August 9, a second bomb was dropped on Nagasaki. 24 days later, on September 7, 1945, the Japanese Empire surrendered. In the years prior to the Japanese surrender, the Empire of Japan had heavily fortified itself in the Dutch East Indies. In the documentary Buitenkampers, The Color of Survival, filmmaker Hetty Nijkens Rachel Helmrich interviews several survivors of that era. One of those people, a woman named Winnie, who at the time was 11 years old, living in the town of Malang. She recalled her experience seeing the Japanese soldiers for the first time.
You would see this endless column of soldiers marching by, typically bandy-legged, and they were all so very small, with slanted eyes, wearing caps with neck flaps on the back.
Dutch and Allied forces responded quickly to the invasion. Soldiers of the Dutch Royal East Indies Army fought bravely along with their Allied brethren to resist the Japanese invasion and hopefully take back the Dutch East Indies to liberate its population from the Japanese Imperial Army. Many soldiers died both on the battlefield and in concentration camps set up by the Japanese during the war. Many of those dead never came home. Today, in Luwakaya Cemetery in Cimahi, Indonesia, lay the buried remains of the fallen soldiers of the Netherlands Royal East Indies Army. Rows of white crosses mark their final resting place. But these soldiers didn't die in battle. They died after the Japanese surrender of World War II. When Japanese Imperial forces conquered the Dutch East Indies, the POW soldiers, which the Japanese had captured, were transported by the Japanese in transport trucks packed together like sardines in overheated conditions or in tightly packed steamships, leaving them subject to being torpedoed by unsuspecting Allied forces. Others were sent on long death marches, being forced miles to walk to locations to be put into forced labor, such as railway construction in places like Sumatra or the now infamous Death Railway between Thailand and Burma, while others were sent into forced labor in the mines of Japan. No matter where the POWs were put to work, the conditions of their labor were excruciating. There was a complete lack of medical care, insufficient food, and even less water. Although the work conditions were brutal and often very dangerous, the labor was preferable to the discipline handed out as punishment by the Japanese. A large number of the POWs in labor camps did not survive. They died, broken, hungry, and completely exhausted. But the POWs were not the only ones sent to the Japanese concentration camps. It was the goal of the Japanese Empire to purge all Western influences from Asian society. In the town of Batu, a young boy of 7 years named Hermann lived with his European family in the community. He recalled seeing how easy it was for the Japanese to enamor themselves to the local ethnic Indonesians.
And overal waar de Japanners binnenkwamen,
wherever the Japanese appeared, they were cheered by the Indonesian people. There were some among them waving small red and white flags, or the Japanese flags with the red ball. And this really surprised us because we had always believed that the loyalty of everyone was to the Dutch queen and country. But that proved not to be the case for large groups of Indonesians. which was an unpleasant experience for us who were living in the Netherlands East Indies. The Japanese made a point of banishing all the European influences from the society. As a result, the people of Dutch descent, the so-called Totoks, were all relocated to internment camps throughout the year 1942. So Europeans effectively disappeared from the streets, except for a handful of Europeans from countries supporting Japan. It happened almost overnight, this banishing of white elements. So the streets took on an Asian rather than a European look.
The Dutch and Dutch-Indonesian civilians were also interred by the Japanese. The men went first. The women and children were interred later. The taking of prisoners in this manner tore families apart. One woman named Ina, who was just 13 years old at the time, lived with her family in the town of Batavia, today known as Jakarta. She recalled the horrifying account of her father being taken prisoner and put in a truck and taken away, never to be seen again.
In mijn gevoel heeft Nederland op 8 maart gecapituleerd.
If I remember correctly, the Dutch troops retreated on March 8th. My father was taken prisoner on March 9th, and on March 10th, I saw trucks passing, filled with men, prisoners of war. And one of those men was my father. We couldn't wave at them. The Japanese would strike you if you did. So I tousled my hair a little bit when he passed, and my dad scratched his head as a signal back, and there went the truck, carrying him, slowly disappearing from view, taking my father out of my life. And at that moment, I cried out, "Daddy, where are they taking you? This is all wrong. What's happening here?" And that's when he disappeared from my life.
The conditions suffered by the civilians in the camps were extreme. They suffered from a lack of food, a lack of water, and a lack of medical supplies, and for many, a lack of safety. Some of the camps were run by extremely sadistic Japanese officers. Cheating was Japanese internment camp for women and children in what is now Jakarta, back then known as Batavia. Initially, there were 2,000 prisoners at Cheating, but by the end of the war, that number had increased to almost 11,000. In April 1944, Cheating came under command of Captain Kenichi Sonai. Sonai would later go on to be infamous for committing brutal atrocities against the POWs. Under his command, POWs would be forced to parade day and night so that every single person could be accounted for. He forced the prisoners into a ritual of deeply bowing towards the direction of Japan, with their hands at their side at just the right place on the seam of a skirt or trousers. If a prisoner didn't do it correctly, that prisoner would be brutally beaten. On September 2, 1946, Sonai was arrested and sentenced to death by Dutch forces. In a unique stroke of irony, Sonai requested a pardon from the Dutch Lieutenant Governor General, Hubertus van Mook. But Van Mook rejected his plea. It turns out that Van Mook's wife had been one of Sonai's prisoners. Sonai's execution was carried out by a Dutch firing squad in December of that year. But Sonai's execution never made up for the deaths of those in the camps. Roughly 13% of the civilian POWs at Cheating never survived. Those who did survive carried trauma with them after the war for the rest of their lives. Some of them are still alive today, but those that did not survive are buried at Luwakaya Cemetery in Cimahi, Indonesia. To this day, it's unclear what the long-term intentions were for the POW civilian prisoners at Cimahi. As a result of the bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, it would never come to that, and the world would never know what the long-term plans of Japan were. When the Japanese Empire surrendered, the POW civilians were free. In the years that followed World War II, the survivors of that time would have to endure much more hardship. In addition to surviving racially motivated POW camps, the Dutch and the Indos would go on to endure even more racial hardship at the hands of the Indonesians, who declared independence after World War II and summarily expelled the Dutch and the Indos from the new country of Indonesia. Many of those Indonesians who were now in Holland would eventually leave and come to the United States and other parts of the world, a result of often feeling like second-class citizens in their own country because of the color of their skin. They would come to new places such as the United States and integrate into their new country. As part of that integration, many Indos chose to not talk or talk very little about the war days back in Indonesia. Descendants of the Botenkampers, as they would come to be known, would often hear just little bits and pieces of stories of their parents' and grandparents' childhood. My Aunt Lucy was just 4 years old, living in Bandung, when the war broke out. She shared her stories in an interview for the documentary Botenkampers, The Color of Survival.
I was 4 years old when the war broke out. I still remember there was a shelter behind the house. And when the air raid sirens began to go off, that's when the bomber airplanes would come overhead. So we had to make a run for the shelter. And we always wore a piece of rubber on a string worn around our necks. So that way, when the bombs started falling, we would bite on this piece of rubber to counteract the air pressure caused by the exploding bombs. That way, your eardrums wouldn't burst.
My uncle Hans also shared his childhood memories of the Japanese invasion during World War II. Hans was just 6 years old, living in the town of Lembang when the war broke out.
Nobody ever told us what a bomb was. We were wearing this thing around our necks. My brother and I ran back uphill, and we couldn't hear each other because of all the noise. Looking back, we saw that the shop we had just left had taken a direct hit, and it was engulfed in flames. My brother tried to make our way back home, but all I could see was a big white blur. Everything else had turned black. Later, when I finally regained consciousness, I felt something heavy pressing down on me. I had no idea what it was. I was confused, and I tried to work out what this thing was, and I pushed it away, and I realized it was probably a dead body of a man in front of me, and that man would have taken the full blast of the bomb, and he probably saved my life. And as I have gotten older, that's what I've come to realize and believe. But I crawled out of this ditch, and I walked back into the street, and I saw my brother also emerging from a ditch to my left. And most of his clothes were gone. I noticed he started to cry, but we couldn't hear each other because we had both been deafened. He was bleeding from his ears and from his nose, and I probably looked just as bad as he did. So we were walking back to where we lived. On both sides of the road, we saw that the bombs had hit, and then a farmhouse to the left of us took a direct hit and was completely blown to bits. Now, we lived maybe two blocks away from where we were, and even at an early age, I always managed to find my way. But when we finally reached the gate of our home, the house was simply gone.
Hearing my uncle tell the story of coming up to his house and finding it simply gone was absolutely heartbreaking. Unfortunately, what happened to my uncle was not uncommon, nor was it the worst thing that people would encounter in those days. After the end of the war came the bersiap period. It would not be unusual to walk down a street on one day and see your neighbors, and then walk up the street later on that same day and find your neighbors dead, their bodies out on their front lawns, their only crime being that they were Indo, and therefore you were considered the enemy. The brutality of the Bersiap period can be very difficult to comprehend. I recently spoke to a woman named Rochelle, whose family is Indo and who has solid generational roots in Indonesia. She recently discovered how severely the Bersiap affected her own family.
I did come across an article recently about a woman who was slaughtered, and I happened to notice that she had the same last name as my Oma, maiden name. And I found that very interesting because our name is just not very common. It's a German name. And she had adopted an Indonesian boy, full-blooded Indonesian boy. She was Dutch Indo. And he slaughtered her with a machete during the Bersiap. And I found that quite shocking. And that was when I really knew how awful the Bersiap was. When I read that article, and then I realized that was a distant cousin's wife, or might have been a distant aunt, I believe, maybe like a great-great aunt, but distantly removed. But she did have the last name of our family because she was married into our family. That was really eye-opening for me, and that's when I started learning more about how brutal the Bersiap was. Up until that point, I knew about the Bersiap, but I didn't fully understand how bad it actually was.
What happened to Rochelle's family is something that would unfortunately happen to many families over and over again. My uncle tells the story of a neighborhood woman who would bake treats for him and his brother.
One night, we were awakened at around 2 a.m. by the sound of dogs barking. And my mother said, we were all awake by now. My mother said, oh, that must be Mrs. Belzer's dogs.
And
Mrs. Belzer lived across the road from us behind Villa Isola. And we used to go there quite often. She made these delicious jams and marmalades. And she didn't have any small children of her own, I believe. So my brother was 10 and I was 9 years old at the time. And the dogs kept barking for a long time. And then they fell silent. So we went back to bed because we used to go to Mrs. Belzer. So the next day, my brother and I went to her place. And that's when I found her. There was nothing left of Mrs. Belzer. Her arms were in one place. Her legs were somewhere else. There was just her midsection there. And there was lots of blood. And the first thing that came to my mind, seeing her like that, was that we'd never be able to enjoy any more baked goods for Mrs. Belzer.
For every story that a survivor of the Bersiap era told, there were numerous other stories that were buried, kept quiet, that nobody wanted to talk about. It was just too painful. After years of struggle and strife, leaving their country for the Netherlands, and then leaving that country again for places like the United States, many Indos worked hard to put that behind them. Many of their children and grandchildren had never heard the stories because they were never told. Rochelle recalls how it just wasn't talked about.
I know my grandparents did not ever speak about that. They spoke about the internment camps. My grandfather was at Changi, which was a very well-known internment camp, had about 10% survival rate. Luckily, he was very young and healthy, and he survived. My grandmother had a little bit kinder treatment, my Oma. She was in a kind of a special camp. It was like almost like a VIP because she was They had a tobacco plantation, and her father did bookkeeping for the tobacco plantation. And because of that, they utilized him for that. And so they got a little bit nicer treatment. And I'm not saying it was good, but I feel like they had a little bit more opportunity. Both of my great-grandfathers died as a result of internment camps.
Even in my own family, stories of those days came in small bits and pieces. I remember many times my mother telling me about how, when the Japanese invaded, my own grandfather, my opa, was sent off to a POW camp for years, leaving his Indonesian wife and 7 Indo children, all of whom had to fend for themselves. My mother was just a young girl at the time, and years later, when my opa was finally released and came home, she had said that he was unrecognizable. She remembered her father as being a tall, handsome, strong man, but the person who came back after the war was this old, weak, feeble man that she didn't recognize at all. For years, it was up to my grandmother, my oma, to take care of her 7 children. In those days, in the war-torn, occupied Dutch East Indies, survival was literally a day-to-day matter. When today came, you would have no idea if you would be alive tomorrow, let alone if you would even be able to eat tomorrow. Food was scarce, and hope was often hard to come by. When many of your days are filled with hopelessness, it's not something you would want to talk about on a regular basis. So many of the survivors simply don't talk about it. In the documentary Buitenkampers, The Color of Survival, a woman named Priscilla, whose parents lived through the war, shares her thoughts on how that era wasn't talked about.
My parents never talked about the war. And I say, why? Why? And then I realized, after a year or so, that they couldn't talk about it. The first generation was so, like my father, like my mother, they cannot talk about it. So we as children inherit that, and it comes out in different ways. Maybe in anger, maybe in questioning everything. We have this background of crises, of trauma that nobody knows about, and we don't even talk about. What we do is we suppress it. We suppress it, and then it comes out.
What Priscilla describes is something that I can personally attest to. Children of Beersheba survivors often feel this pressure of juggling their cultural past with the need to integrate into contemporary society. Earlier, we heard from Ina, who as a child saw her father being taken away on a truck. She shares her thoughts on the weight that children often have to bear.
My youngest son, when he went through a very difficult time in his personal life, came to the following conclusion. He said, "The rocks that belong to my father, I've put them in my backpack, and they've always weighed me down. I'm going to have to work really hard to get those rocks out of my backpack. I have enough of my own weight to carry. I don't need to carry Dad's rocks." And that's the problem with parents keeping silent about this. They pass it on to their children. Their children fill their backpacks with those rocks of silence.
The story of the Beersheba survivors is the story of survival. The heritage of Indos everywhere is one of triumph through tragedy. As one famous Dutch Reformed pastor said, "Tough times never last, but tough people do." It is within the DNA of the Dutch and Indo people to build something from nothing, and it's something they've done in their history many times. The descendants of the Beersheba survivors share a common bond of gratitude and appreciation for everything that their parents and grandparents did before them. We, their descendants, will never forget what they had to endure, and will always remember how they overcame. I'm John von Waltzigen. Thank you for joining me. For further information, be sure to check out the documentary Botenkampers, The Color of Survival by Hetty Nykens-Rachel Helmrich, and be sure to check out theindoproject.org for more information.